Hello and welcome to Slice of Science, a show all about curiosity, science, and the world around us. My name is Michelle Sims and I'll be your host for the next half hour. You're listening to Radio Adelaide 101.5 FM. Tonight, I'm talking about PFAS, or forever chemicals. You may have heard about these chemicals. Maybe you've seen the headlines about forever chemicals causing health effects in the news. Health effects like hormone disruption or cancer or causing low birth weight in babies. Or maybe you've watched the movie Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway. Ooh. Based on the first lawsuit over these chemicals, which was this monumental David and Goliath lawsuit, which had a farmer versus one of the biggest, probably the biggest chemical manufacturing companies, DuPont. Or maybe you've been following the class action here in Australia, which is against our government. These class actions were over contaminated land that was contaminated with firefighting foam, which contained these PFAS or forever chemicals. So in 2020, there was a class action against the government for PFAS contamination in Katherine, which is in Northern Territory, Oakey, which is in Queensland, and Williamtown, which is in New South Wales. And then another was settled just last year, which involved Royal Australian Air Force bases at Richmond and Wagga Wagga in New South Wales, Ballsbrook in Western Australia, Darwin in the Northern Territory, Edinburgh in South Australia, and Townsville in Queensland and Wodonga in Victoria. Both class actions were won and were settled by the people. And the first one was settled with the government owing the people $212.5 million the government owed the people that were affected. And the second one, the people settled for $132 million. I do want to highlight, though, that is $132 million for 30,000 affected residents, which I don't really know how they worked out how they're going to divide that, but if you divide it equally, that's about $4,400 each. So I guess they would divide it depending on how much their land was affected. But yeah, I just think it's very interesting. But we don't know yet what the full effect of these chemicals are. And interestingly, these lawsuits were actually only over economic loss. So if they had a farm and they couldn't use it anymore, or even just the loss, like their diminishing value of their land as well, because of the contamination. So lots of these people they can't grow veggies on their land, they can't farm on their land because it's contaminated, and they can't really sell because people know that area is contaminated. So people kind of ended up, in a bit of a hard spot from contamination that was caused by the government. So you can see why these lawsuits happened. But yeah, it's interesting that these lawsuits were only over economic loss. They think that the lawsuits that are over health effects are yet to come. Apparently, there's going to be some more lawsuits coming over the years about that. Tonight, I'm going to be talking about PFAS chemicals. What are they? What are the known health effects? Where are they? What are they in? What products are they in? How can we avoid them? Can we avoid them? Are they everywhere? And then I want to talk a bit about what my PhD project is, which is looking at what the effect of these chemicals are on bacteria and fungi. And why should we care about that? Why should we care what PFAS is doing to bacteria and fungi when it might be hurting us, maybe some people are thinking? Could these microorganisms break down these forever chemicals? Fungi and bacteria have been known to break down a wide range of chemicals. They've been known to accumulate heavy metals. They've been known to break down pharmaceutical products in wastewater, which I think is an interesting thing people don't think about with their pharmaceutical products. You know, taking a prescription drug, you kind of take it and don't really think about what's going to happen afterwards. But then when it gets eliminated from your body, when you pee or poo, there's little bits of that chemical in there and that ends up in the wastewater and what kind of happens there? What goes on? It's just in the earth. It's just in the world. And then, for example, lots of people take antidepressants. What's what's happening if the waterways are full of antidepressants from everyone taking them? What happens to the animals? Anyway, not what the show's about. But yeah, fungi and bacteria have been known to break down these pharmaceuticals, which is awesome. We want that. And they're so good at it. That's what their job is on Earth, is to break things down. They are the decomposers of the Earth. They're the world's recyclers. So I would like to find out if fungi or bacteria could also break down PFAS. But the thing with PFAS is there's a couple things about it that make it a little bit more complicated. So we'll see. Welcome back to Slice of Science. We're talking all about PFAS, which is my PhD topic, actually. And it's great timing because tomorrow is a really big day for me and my PhD. I have my confirmation of candidature, which is basically where 1 year into your PhD at Flinders, they sort of just have a little checkpoint to see how your project's going. How are you going? Have you got some results so far? And if they think that you're not doing so well, then they kind of give you a bit of a warning and they say, oh, like, get your project together in 3 months. Otherwise, you're getting downgraded to a master's. But I don't think that will happen to me. I think it will be hopefully okay. Hopefully I didn't just jinx it then. But yeah, so tomorrow I've got a oral presentation that goes for half an hour and I'm talking all about my PhD topic, which is PFAS. So PFAS, what is PFAS? Well, PFAS is not just one chemical. It's actually a group of about 9,000 different chemicals, or it's called a chemical family. But this is also really hotly debated in the research field because I've seen PFAS defined as anywhere from 4,000 different chemicals to 15,000 different chemicals, which is a huge jump. What, how are they defining these? But this is because there's a lot to debate in the scientific field about how we can define them. So let's go into a bit of chemistry here. Hold your horses. PFAS stands for per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. What does this mean? Okay, so to put it simply, a PFAS chemical is a chemical that has fluorine atoms on its carbon chain. The reason the number of PFAS chemicals is so varied is because we don't really know whether to define PFAS as a chemical that has, you know, a chemical structure that has one fluorine atom, or do we define a PFAS if it has two fluorine atoms, or do we say three or more? We don't really know. So, for example, fluorine atoms are often added to prescription medicine to increase the drug's stability in the body. We want the drug to stick around long enough to actually have an effect. So fluorine is often added to, yeah, increase this, make it stay around in the body for a bit longer. So I want to talk about fluorine for a sec because I find it really interesting. Now that I started researching this, I think it's so very interesting. And chemistry, I've always enjoyed chemistry. I always found it a little bit difficult, but you know, now I'm getting back into it more. I'm thinking, no, I remember this and I really love this. You may have only heard about fluorine from the word fluoride, which is added to toothpaste or tap water. This is generally in the form of sodium fluoride or a few others as well. But fluoride and fluorine are different. Fluorine is the element in its natural form, whereas fluoride is when it's in its ion form, which means it's gained an electron. So they are kind of the same thing, but actually quite different. Why does fluorine like to gain an electron to become fluoride? Why does it want to do this so often? Well, fluorine is actually the most electronegative atom in the periodic table, which means its pull for electrons is really, really strong because it only needs one more electron to be complete. So it's pulling basically anything to say, hey, come join, give me your electron. And this is the same for all elements in that row on the periodic table. These are all called halogens. Other halogens that you might have heard of include chlorine, bromine, iodine, astatine, and tennessine. Tennessine is actually an element that was created by humans. It's not found naturally in the environment. It was created by humans by like smashing element. I don't know how they made it, actually. But yeah, they called it tennis scene. Yeah. But you've likely heard of chlorine, even chloride, in its iron form. Sodium chloride, you definitely know, because that's table salt. These halogens are actually named after salt. The word halo is the Greek prefix for salt. All of these chemicals love to get together with other they love to get together with other elements because they can steal their electron from when they can steal their electron when they bond with other elements. And when chemicals do that, we say they're in their salt form. So that fluorine, very keen to pull electrons from other elements, and very, very rarely is it found in its natural form in the environment. We didn't find fluorine just as it is until, I think, 2012. They found it in a cave, because in its natural form, it's green and it's a gas and it's quite stinky, apparently. But it's just so rarely found like that. They found it in a cave within a rock or something, just very rare, because it always wants to be with something else. It's very, very needy, and super reactive, so we just don't find it by itself. But in the world, there's plenty of fluorine in its salt form, generally in the form of calcium fluoride, also known as fluorite or fluorspar. And I urge you to look up fluorspar on Google Images, because it is stunning. It is so beautiful. You've probably seen it like at markets and stuff. Because of its impurities, it comes in all these different colours, and it's like beautiful light greens, beautiful purples, yellows and oranges. It's just, it's so pretty. And the way they manufacture a PFAS is they actually mine this fluorspar for their fluorine atoms. And it's so crazy, because they put the most beautiful thing, something really, really not beautiful, to make PFAS. They get the fluorine from fluorspar, the beautiful, beautiful gems, and they need a carbon, they need a carbon chain to make the PFAS chemical. And this comes from fossil fuel extractions. So yeah, fluorspar plus fossil fuel extractions pretty much equals PFAS, with a couple more steps on the way. But that's basically where the very raw materials come from. It's actually quite a dirty secret that all plastics, and PFAS included, because some PFAS are plastic but not all, come from fossil fuels. These two really huge industries are responsible for massive pollution on Earth and our atmosphere, and they're really founded and dependent on the same industry. Like, it's just fossil fuels. And I found out this fact this year, and it really grinded my gears. Some fossil fuel companies are actually looking to increase their production of plastics going forward so they can protect profit loss for the transition to renewables. So because fluorine has this crazy want for another electron, the bond that carbon and fluorine make when they are put together is so strong. It's one of the strongest bonds known in chemistry. This is partly why it's called forever chemicals. It's so difficult to destroy these bonds, to completely pull them apart and wreck them again. Also, if we could break apart that bond, what would happen is fluoride ions would be released. So in the case where we're trying to find out whether bacteria or fungi can break down PFAS chemicals, this really complicates things, because we use fluoride, like I said, in toothpaste to kill fungi and bacteria. Like, it's so widely known to be toxic to microbes that we use it in toothpaste for that reason. So if bacteria and fungi can break apart that fluorine-carbon bond, then it also has to overcome the toxicity from the fluoride. So this is another reason why PFAS are so resistant to natural biodegradation in the environment. It's just so difficult to overcome this. But some bacteria and fungi have actually been known to overcome this. It's been, if you have a gene called a fluoride resistance gene, and a few other genes, that can mean that the fungi is resistant to the fluoride ions. So in my research, we want to kind of target, when I'm looking for microbes that might degrade PFAS, want to kind of target ones, look at their gene expression and see if they express this gene, because we know that's probably going to be kind of essential if we want to find something that's going to break down PFAS. So we're talking about PFAS here on Slice of Science. Welcome back. Let's get back into it. I spent so long talking about the chemistry of PFAS because I think it's so interesting that I forgot to even say what it does and what's it in. So the chemistry of PFAS, which I talked about before, those really strong carbon-fluorine bonds that are key to PFAS chemicals, these create these really unique properties that we find with PFAS chemicals, that they can repel oil, they can repel grease, they can repel water. So this makes things non-stick or stain resistant. This meant that when they were first created, DuPont was like, let's put this in something we need non-stick for. So they made Teflon, which you might have heard before. So I think all probably non-stick pans have a form of PFAS in them. So one way to avoid PFAS is to not use non-stick pans and to use ceramic or stainless steel pans, which I know they're a bit more annoying to use, but they have found that anytime you get a scrape in the non-stick pans, which I'm sure we all have, thousands of PFAS chemicals get released into your food. So yeah, it's probably good to change. PFAS are also resistant to extreme temperatures and other chemicals, so nothing really destroys them. They're also used to reduce friction. So this is what we call a surfactant, which basically just means a soap. So they are used often in like industrial lubricants. They're used in fracking, of course. But some other things they're used for, like I mentioned before, was firefighting foam used on fuel fires. They found it was a collaboration with the big chemical giant called 3M and the US Defense Force or Navy. They collaborated together to create this aqueous film firefighting foam, which is used on fuel fires. And it was so, so useful, and it worked really well before they realized that this stuff sticks around for ages and we can never get rid of it. But it's also found in lots of waterproof clothing, like waterproof jackets. Gore-Tex recently had a massive lawsuit for having PFAS in their products, and they knew about it and they knew about the harms. I know Lululemon and other sort of leggings have been found to have PFAS in them as well. Patagonia has actually moved away from PFAS. They're trying not to use it anymore. So companies like that are trying to do the right thing. It's not all bad. But also, PFAS is found in household chemicals. They've found PFAS in toilet rolls. They've found PFAS in about 50% of the cosmetics that they've tested. So I tell my friends, don't ever buy a waterproof mascara or a waterproof lipstick. But it's even harder to avoid than that because it's not on the label whether it has PFAS in it generally. And it doesn't just stick to the waterproof stuff. It's in a lot of stuff that's not considered waterproof. Also in menstrual products, pads and tampons, a lot of them have found, they've found PFAS in pads and tampons to kind of, I think it was to be a barrier from your underwear and the pad to stop any leaks. Then the company Thinks, which is a reusable pad company, they recently had a lawsuit for having PFAS in their products as well. So it's kind of hard to avoid in that sense. You want to not use pads and tampons if they've been found to have PFAS in them, but then the reusable ones have as well. It's a bit tough. Food packaging is another big one. We've moved away from plastic takeaway containers, but now we're in this situation where lots of food packaging is lined, so those cardboard boxes is lined with that shiny stuff inside, which is generally PFAS. So this is another big problem because when you put that in your organic bins get, you know, put on a farm, and then what, that farm is farming vegetables and there's PFAS going on the vegetables. Not great. Another bad one is microwave popcorn, which made me so sad when I found out. I could have cried because I love microwave popcorn. So that's a really quick and easy way to avoid PFAS if you want to, for you and your kids. I know it's kind of annoying to make on the stove, but we found the other day one of our housemates left a popcorn maker, and it's called Cornelius, and it works so well. So I urge you to invest in that maybe. So because we've put it in absolutely in almost everything, we've put PFAS in so many different things, we're in this situation now where it's, you know, all of our landfill contains PFAS, and then that gets into the ground beneath the landfill, which can then get into the groundwater. Once PFAS chemicals are in groundwater or any water, they can actually move very far, very long distances, because they're quite soluble in water. So now they've found PFAS in sea spray, they've found PFAS in air, they've found PFAS in polar bears in the Arctic, also found PFAS in rain. Household dust has PFAS as well. There were studies even done in Adelaide that were on household dust with PFAS contamination. Also, almost all blood samples have had PFAS in them as well that they've tested. Another one is biosolids, which we use in kind of a circular economy way, which come from like our sewage, and they keep our sewage for a while, and like they have bacteria and fungi in there that kind of breaks down the rest of the stuff until you're left with this really nutrient-dense sort of fertilizer stuff. And it's awesome, because then we put it back on agricultural land to help grow veggies. A really great thing. But then the bad thing about that is countries are now starting to realize, oh, because PFAS is kind of everywhere, and it might be in like the drugs we're taking, it might be in shampoo we're using, it's getting into our waterways, and then eventually it's in the biosolids. And then we're just putting it back on land. So Germany actually banned biosolids for being used in fertilizer, which, yeah, it's a really tough thing, because it's such a good thing that we're doing, but it's also like, well, if that's the situation. So the other problem with PFAS is they bioaccumulate in our bodies, which means they build up in our bodies and in animals, and they tend to magnify up the food chain as well. So if I eat a large fish, it's probably going to have more PFAS in it than a small fish. So that's on sardines. The other thing about PFAS is they have really quite long half-lives, which means half-life is the time that it takes for half of the chemical that you've ingested to be eliminated from the body. I'm running out of time a bit here. I obviously love talking about PFAS a little bit too much, but I will say some of the half-lives of PFAS. PFOA, which is one PFAS, is 2.7 years. Another PFAS, PFOS, 3.4 years. And then the last one, PFHXS, has a half-life of 5.3 years. So 5.3 years is the time it takes in general for this PFAS to be eliminated from, for half of this PFAS to be eliminated from our body. So it's pretty wild. Oh, I haven't even talked about health effects yet.